This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dexter Filkins, is a Baghdad correspondent for the New York Times. He's been covering Iraq since the start of the invasion in 2003. Earlier this year, he won a George Polk Award for war reporting. Yesterday, I spoke with Filkins just before he caught a plane that would begin his journey back to Baghdad. It was the end of a two-day trip to the U.S. that he made after covering last Thursday's election. We asked him to talk with us about the election and the impact it could have on the insurgency and the American presence in Iraq. This was the first election for a full-term parliament since the end of Saddam Hussein's rule. Dexter Filkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. Where were you on Election Day, and why did you choose that spot?
I was in Baghdad, where I'm based, and I was able to drive to various neighborhoods around the city. There was basically no traffic allowed anywhere in the country for security reasons for a couple days each side of the election. And you could drive if you had sort of a special, you know, big decal on, that you put on your windshield so that when you came to a checkpoint, they wouldn't shoot at you. What was really different was I went to Adamiya, which is a big Sunni neighborhood, sort of the northern part of Baghdad. And ordinarily, honestly, I can't go to a neighborhood like that. I'm not really sure that I would live very long in a neighborhood like that. And I was able to go on Thursday, and it was peaceful, it was quiet. People were voting, and as opposed to January in the first elections, nobody voted. The streets were empty. It was kind of spooky. There were death threats all over the place. There were handbills saying, if you vote, you die. And this time around, it was, you know, just like every other place in the city. So it was really encouraging. People were waving. They were bringing their families with them, you know, pushing wheelchairs. So it was quite something to see in that particular neighborhood.
Why were you safer in this Sunni city on Election Day than you would be at any other time?
I don't know, frankly. I think, honestly, the mood had changed. And it may only last for a day. And it may be over now, but for that day, the atmosphere was different, the people were different, and it's really hard to explain. And I mean, the easy thing to say would be that there were, you know, 400,000 American and Iraqi troops and police out on the streets, and they, you know, of the country, and they locked it down, and so things were much safer, and that was definitely part of it, that the people felt secure enough to go out and to vote. But I think that there was something more intangible and probably more important going on, which is people's outlook changed, and they wanted to vote, and they saw that there was reason to vote, and that, you know, they might actually get something out of it. And so that's what I think had changed. That's what I felt, and that's certainly what people on the streets told me, that it seemed different this time.
Well, you write that a lot of Iraqi Shiites and a lot of Kurds believe that the Sunnis elected to the parliament could end up serving as a kind of political wing for the insurgency, kind of like what Sinn Féin was for the IRA. So what leads people to believe that?
Well, there's just so much suspicion, you know, among all the communities there. And there really isn't any expectation among Iraqis or the American military there that the insurgency is going to go away. And I think there isn't really an expectation in the Sunni community that the insurgency is going to go away. And so I think what people are seeing is kind of a two-track thing. And it just depends. I mean, it just depends how it works out in practice. When, say, you get a big block of Sunni Arabs in the parliament, what are they going to do? Are they going to try to work constructively and pass legislation that they want and try to help their community and try to amend the constitution, which they don't like? Or are they simply going to obstruct and block and essentially be a political front for the insurgency? And nobody really knows, you know, and you know, we'll see when the time comes. But that's certainly the fear on the part of a good deal of the other Iraqis.
So the fact that a lot of Sunnis showed up to vote is not necessarily a sign that the insurgency is going to end.
No, it's not. I mean, it's not immediately. I think that there is a sense, and again, these things are really, really intangible and they're hard to measure, but there's certainly a sense in the American military. And if you talk to the Sunnis themselves, and this is what's really important, I got a sense that there is something of a gap between say, the mainstream civilian Sunni population and the insurgents, and particularly maybe not, you know, what they would refer to as the sort of nationalist insurgency, but with a gap between them and the Zarqawis and the car bombers and the people who do suicide bombings in big areas populated by civilians, that there's kind of a distance that's growing between them. And it might only be, you know, 3 inches, but it might be 6 feet, but that there's a gap. And so I think that to the extent that there is a gap, whether it's the Americans or the Iraqi government, they want to make the gap bigger. They want to separate the insurgency, or even if it's only part of the insurgency, from the rest of the Sunni population and bring the Sunnis into the democratic process.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dexter Filkins. He's a Baghdad correspondent for the New York Times, and he's just been in the States a couple of days, and he's about to fly back to Iraq. Well, so far, according to preliminary results, the main Shiite coalition is in the lead, as was expected. The Sunnis are demanding a new ballot for Baghdad. They think there were too many irregularities in the vote. I know you've been in the States for the past couple of days, but what have you heard about this?
Well, immediately. I mean, I was there on election day and there for a couple of days after. And all through the day and election day and afterwards, there were a zillion allegations of fraud and you know, ballot stuffing and that sort of thing. And you know, those things are impossible to prove immediately. But, you know, there is a certain amount of discontent. But I think that, I mean, this is a good time to mention, but I think one of the things that you notice or that you run into all the time, and I think it underlies one of the biggest problems in Iraq right now, is the Sunni minority, which by virtually any kind of expert opinion is a minority, 15 or 20% of the population, but nonetheless they ran the country for hundreds of years in one way or another. If you talk to a typical Sunni person on the street, they will tell you, and I think they firmly believe, that they're a majority of the population, and they don't think they're a minority. They certainly don't act like a minority. And so I think that it's going to be surprising and possibly embittering to them when they don't get a majority of the seats in parliament. And so I think there may be some of that at work at the moment.
So the Shiite coalition that is in the lead so far in the parliamentary elections in Iraq, what's its agenda?
That's a really big and important question. The answer is kind of elusive. You know, if you ask them, if somebody like me asks them what their agenda is, you know, they'll say it's mostly secular state with kind of an Islamic flavor, with no outside interference, and you know, with civil rights for all, including women, and with, you know, participation from the Sunnis and everybody else. But I think that there's a lot of suspicion and a lot of doubts about those assertions, and I think that there's a lot of different concerns depending on who you are. You know, the Americans I know are concerned about Iranian influence. You know, the big Shiite parties are thought to be, and probably are, you know, funded by the Iranian government. A lot of the militiamen have been trained there, and get support from the Iranians. And that's not viewed generally by anybody else in Iraq, except for the Shiites, as a really positive influence. I mean, that's one thing. And then the whole other question, of course, is how Islamic they want the state to be. And nobody really knows, but if you go to a place like Basra or someplace in southern Iraq, places like that which are under control and have been under local control of these parties, they're very heavily Islamic. Just when you walk down the street and you see all the women in abayas and just, you know, with their head covered and most of their face. And so, you know, I think the evidence makes some people nervous. But I think, if I could just say, I think the biggest concern about the Shiite coalition is, if they come into power, what that's going to mean for the Sunnis. Because, you know, goal number one, I think, of the Iraqi government now, and certainly the American government, is to bring the Sunnis in and to give them a stake in the system. And I think that there's a general concern that's going to be less likely to happen if these guys are in power, that the Sunnis are not going to want to sit across the table from the Shiite coalition. And for that matter, the Shiite coalition doesn't want to sit across the table from the Sunnis. You know, they don't like each other. They've got too much history. There's too much, you know, it's an awful history with a lot of death. And that they just don't, you know, that they're not going to be able to see eye to eye on things. And that's the biggest concern about the Shiite coalition.
You say that, you know, the Shiites are considered to be aligned with Iran, possibly backed by Iran. Recently, police seized a tanker truck that was headed from Iran to Iraq with thousands of forged ballots. So how do you interpret that? Like, how significant is that? And have you learned anything beneath the surface about that?
Well, I mean, the context for it is just that there's a web of contacts and a web, you know, kind of a support network between the Iranian government and the Shiite, the big Shiite parties. Dawa is one. There's another one, the Supreme Council. Those are the two big Shiite parties. And they have a, you know, they've got a history. The Supreme Council, all their leadership spent time in Iran. Same with Dawa. The big militia, armed militia, the Badr Brigade, was trained in Iran and actually fought in Iran against the Iraqis in the Iran-Iraq War. So there's a history there, and there's a kind of web of connections. Now, you know, how many ballots came in the country and how many were actually used, I don't know. But I think it's an illustration of the interest that the Iranian government has in having their friends in charge.
It just is great that so many people turned out to vote. But the election, depending on how it works out, can actually have a divisive effect on Iraq in the sense that the Kurds want to have autonomy in the Kurdish area. And they want control, I think, of the oil in that area. So I'm sure the Sunni and Shia do not approve of that. Are there various ways that the election can turn out that would lead to further contention or splits or possibly even civil war in Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. And, you know, when you look back through history, there's any number of civil wars that were preceded by elections. And elections can, not necessarily, but they can certainly have a way of sharpening the differences between communities. And that's been happening in Iraq for, you know, ever since the invasion, for better or for worse. You see that in so many different ways. I mean, the most stark example of that, and probably the most troubling, is under the current government, which is Shiite dominated, there's been a growing number of reports, and really kind of the evidence for it is fairly overwhelming, that the armed militias have been, the Shiite militias have been incorporated into the security services like the police and the interior ministry and that sort of thing, and that they've been going into Sunni neighborhoods and killing and kidnapping and torturing and disappearing young Sunni men, most of whom are civilians, or any number of whom are civilians. And that's really, really sharpened the differences, you know, between those two communities. And that's the kind of thing that's been happening. So I think after the votes are counted here and everybody's got to sit down, yeah, there's just gigantic differences that have to be overcome, some of which have been kind of sharpened and clarified by this election.
Do the different parties have their own militias?
Most of them do. Most of them do. I mean, for example, both the Kurdish, the big Kurdish parties have their militias, the Peshmerga. The Badr Brigade is the militia, Iranian-trained militia of the Supreme Council. Muqtada al-Sadr, who has, you know, any number of, will probably capture a lot of parliamentary seats after the votes are counted. He has the Mahdi army. And it's really a, you know, in any kind of functioning modern state, the central government has a monopoly on the use of force. And that's not really true in Iraq. And it's not true at all. And so it's a prescription potentially for, you know, for terrible, terrible troubles down the road. And so, yeah, they all do have their militias is the short answer.
And I guess groups don't like to give up their militias very easily.
No, they don't. They don't. There's been, you know, any number of, you know, plans and programs that are kind of, you know, big, thick reports about how they're going to do it, and it's never really happened. And I think one of the things that has happened, which I alluded to a few minutes ago, was that some of the militias have just gone straight into the police departments and straight into the interior ministry and into the army. And so the allegiances now are kind of blurred. So it's a question of who's, you know, Ahmed, the police officer, taking orders from? Is he taking orders from the police chief, or is he still really taking orders from his, you know, his militia commander, who he spent 15 years with and, you know, trained in Iran, and they've been fighting together in various ways, you know, and have a long history together? Who's he taking orders from? And, you know, and will he be loyal to the state, or will he be loyal to the party? And so that's how complicated and troubling it is.
What are some of the possible ways that the outcome of the election might affect the future of America's presence in Iraq? I mean, do some of the groups, like does the Shiite coalition, want America out as soon as possible?
The Shiite coalition, no. I mean, they might sort of say it occasionally and, you know, throw a bone to the crowd, but no. The short answer is no. I think the Sunni minority, and however many seats they end up with in Parliament, I don't know, you know, say 50 out of 275 seats, they definitely do. And so, you know, maybe there would be a coalition government where they would have to temper some of the language, or there'd be some kind of concession. But the short answer is there isn't. Among the leadership in Iraq and among the elites, the political elites, almost across the board, there isn't much appetite for ordering the Americans out. I think these days, at least in Iraq, what it feels like is that the Americans want to leave, and it's not really all that clear that the Iraqis want them to, or certainly the Iraqi politicians. I mean, you know, on the street, it's a different matter. So I think what you're going to see is over the next year is going to be really, really interesting, because as the Iraqi security services and the army become more competent, there's a kind of growing pressure. There's obviously a growing political pressure in the United States for the American soldiers to come home. And so I think what you're going to see, and what we have been seeing, is the Americans kind of pushing the Iraqis to the front and saying, it's time for you to take over. And if you don't take over, we're going to sit down anyway. So you better take over because we're leaving. And that's kind of what you're seeing at the moment. Whether the Americans actually leave or not, that's what they're trying to do at the moment.
In American TV news coverage of the voting last Thursday in Iraq, there were pictures of women wearing the abaya, the full body cover, going to the polls to vote. And are more women covering themselves like that now? Are things becoming more conservative for women and women's rights in Iraq?
Yes, they are. There's no question. I mean, I think if you're a secular woman who, you know, a professional woman, educated, I think you feel like your life is a lot tougher than it's been, you know, over the last couple of years, because things are changing. And I think the general trend and the atmosphere there is much more conservative vis-a-vis women. I mean, if you look at the Constitution that was just approved, there's some language in there that I think, again, educated secular women find very, very troubling stuff. For example, that appears to allow, clerics to decide matters of marriage and divorce and inheritance and adoption and those sorts of things. So I think that. You know, and I know some of them, secular educated women are feeling pretty embattled these days.
Do you think that some secular educated women are going to be leaving Iraq because of this?
It's funny you say that. I can only call her a friend because I've known her for so long, Raja Kuzai, who's an obstetrician, Shiite woman, practiced medicine in London from Diwaniya, which is a almost entirely Shiite city in southern Iraq. And I've known her since the beginning, and she's a wonderful person. She's very secular and very educated and very articulate. And I interviewed her not long after the Constitution was you know, fixed and agreed upon. And she said, this is not what I've fought for. And this is not what I imagined in the new Iraq, and there really isn't any reason for me to stay anymore. And that was a couple months ago, and I haven't seen her around, and I don't frankly know where she is. And so I'll make it a point when I go back to look around for her. But I think that's a kind of measure of, I think, what women like that are feeling.
And do you think if many secular women left Iraq, that it would make it easier for women's rights to be diminished because there wouldn't be active women fighting against it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you take somebody like Raja Kuzai, she, you know, that's priority number one for her. And she raises her voice, and she's not afraid to. And she's not afraid to fight for what she wants. And, and if every time you lose somebody like that, I think, sure, their cause... their cause is diminished as well.
I think that many people assume that Iraq was a pretty secular country. Maybe that was in part because Saddam Hussein was comparatively secular or not terribly religious, although he seemed to get a kind of religious rebirth in his last period in power. But is Iraq turning out to be more religious than a lot of people thought?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as for Saddam, I mean, the Ba'ath Party was a product of, you know, this kind of this movement in the 50s and 60s that was basically Arab nationalist. It's secular. It's, you know, it was anti-communist, then secular, nationalistic, and not terribly religious at all. But, you know, again, that was the Ba'ath Party and particularly Saddam. That was largely a Sunni Arab phenomenon. That's a small percentage of the population. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, probably 60% of the population, which is very, very religious and repressed for many, many years, many centuries, really. Of being of the same sect, which is to say Shiite, as Iran next door. And so when the lid was taken off of that and it was allowed to flourish, it did. And I think that's what we're seeing.
In a recent article, you quoted President Bush as having said, we would, quote, settle for nothing less than complete victory, unquote. And then you said, when the president promises nothing less than complete victory over the Iraqi insurgency, the proliferation of militant groups offers perhaps the best explanations as to why the insurgency has been so hard to destroy. And in this article, you just kind of listed a whole bunch of different insurgency groups and said that estimates are as high as 100 different insurgent groups. Why is it significant that there are so many different insurgent groups?
Well, if you look at if you imagine a typical military structure, you know, if you had to draw it, it would be, you know, it'd be a triangle. It would be, there's the general at the top, and then there's all the troops at the bottom, and then they kind of execute orders, and the job gets done. And that's not what this insurgency looks like at all. It's a very flat kind of horizontal thing. And the effect of that is, I mean, by flat and horizontal, I mean that there's not much of a leadership, there's not much of a hierarchy. It's a bunch of different, more or less independent cells or groups that more or less operate on their own. You know, they get help and they get money and they get suicide bombers that come in from outside the country and that sort of thing. But for the most part, they operate on their own. And what that means is, if you're the American military, is if you attack group, you know, whether it's the East Bakuba, you know, jihadi lions or something, and you find that group and you destroy that group, it doesn't really mean all that much. It doesn't mean beyond that group, it doesn't mean anything at all, or it means very little, because all these groups operate more or less independently of one another. So you can't really take the head off the thing because there isn't much of a head. And so it's just a much more diffuse thing to attack, and it's almost as if it was built with you know, survivability in mind. But I think it's just a much more complicated kind of phenomenon that they're fighting.
What do they have in common?
Well, what they all really share is a desire to get the Americans out of Iraq. I mean, after that, I think there's not, you know, there's much less agreement. I mean, some of them want to set up, you know, an Islamic State, and some of them would like to return the, you know, Saddam Hussein to power. Some of them would probably quit fighting if the Americans left. That's the main thing that unites them.
In his speech on Sunday night, President Bush said, "My fellow citizens, not only can we win the war in Iraq, we are winning the war in Iraq." And I'm wondering how much you've been speaking to military leaders in Iraq and how what they tell you compares to what the president has been telling the American public.
Well, they when you talk to American officers there, by and large, they're very, very realistic. You don't usually hear a lot of high-flown rhetoric, high-flown remarks, but it's more, it's much more sober and reasoned. But I'd say I think, I don't know what they would say about we are winning the war. I think that they would say we can win the war, and the war is still winnable. Most of the ones that I've talked to firmly and absolutely believe that. I think they'd be probably a little bit more cautious about the progress that's been made to date.
The president also said, in this vote 6,000 miles away in a vital region of the world means that America has an ally of growing strength in the fight against terror. Does this election ensure that the new government will be an ally of the United States?
Yeah, this election will put a parliament, it'll seat a parliament that with a term of 4 years. And I think by pretty much any combination you can imagine over the next 4 years, any government that will come out of that parliament is going to want the Americans to stay. It doesn't mean that they're going to agree on everything, but first and foremost, they're going to want the Americans there, helping them build their new state. And so in that sense, yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say.
Dexter Filkins is my guest. He's a Baghdad correspondent for the New York Times, and he's been in the States a couple of days and is about to go back to Iraq tonight. The last time you were on the show, which was in September, you talked about how each time you return to Iraq, it's changed, and each time you go there, your experience of the place is different than it was the time before. What has characterized this past couple of months for you?
I think what's characterized the last couple of months for me is just there's a greater sense of uncertainty about where it's going and how fast. It's such an incredibly complicated place. I wrote in a story a couple of days ago that it's a kaleidoscope, and when the election happened, the kaleidoscope turned again, and it's a different pattern, and that's kind of the way Iraq has been. You think you have it, and you focus on it, and there's a picture there, and then suddenly the picture blurs, and it becomes something else. And that's the way it's been this whole. I've been there for, I don't know, 8 or 10 weeks this last time, and the kaleidoscope just keeps turning, and you say, is it getting better? Is it getting worse? Are things improving? How's it going? And every day you ask yourself that question, and just about every day you get a different answer.
Do you feel any more or less safe reporting?
Yeah, it's been pretty safe there. There were some kidnappings there a few weeks back, but it hasn't. A year ago it was really bad for reporters, and particularly with the kidnappings, and you know, people were getting beheaded and that sort of thing. That was a pretty spooky time. There was a couple of incidents that were very, very troubling. One was the triple truck bombing. I don't think I've ever used that phrase before, of the Palestine and the Sheraton hotels, and then right about a week after that or so, there was a big truck bombing of the Hamra Hotel. And those hotels are basically, I mean, practically their only inhabitants are journalists, and so it was pretty clear, it was made pretty clear to everybody, all the reporters there, that they're coming after us, you know. And actually, in the case of the Palestine and the Sheraton, they were trying to bring both of those big, tall hotels down, and they had a truck bomb that blew open a hole in the concrete walls, big enough for two more trucks to go through, you know, probably one for each, you know, hotel lobby to bring those hotels down. It didn't happen, and they got kind of hung up. But I should say they just missed. And at the Hamra, it was much the same thing, and they just missed, and they did a lot of damage. The New York Times house happens not to be terribly far, just a couple hundred yards away from the Palestine and the Sheraton, and all of our windows were blown out. There was actually a smoking car radiator that landed in our yard, and shrapnel came into the house and everything else. It was a pretty crazy time. But after a couple weeks after the attack on the Sheraton and the Palestine, there was a videotape surfaced, I think, on one of the jihadi websites that was made before the attack on the Palestine and the Sheraton Hotel. And there was literally a PowerPoint presentation that one of these insurgent guys was giving. And there was a big photograph of the towers. And at one point he points to, I don't know, the fourth or fifth floor of the Palestine Hotel. And he says, this is where the foreign journalists are. And so, that got our attention. And so it's in that sense, it's kind of creepy because, they haven't made an effort like that in some time to come after the foreign journalists. But it looks like that's changing.
So are reporters moving out of those hotels which have become targets?
They are. I think a number of offices were a couple of offices of, you know, American newspapers were destroyed in the Hamra attack, and I'm not sure in the Palestine, but I know, yeah, people are definitely moving.
Where?
Well, some of them are going. Unfortunately, they feel like they have to go to the green zone, which is, you know, if you're a journalist, it's just not ideal because it's so hard to get in and out of. It takes forever. You know, you're really not in the real Iraq, and so it's just not ideal. And not, you know, anybody who does it doesn't really want to do it. And so I think they're only doing it because they feel like they have to.
So when you have your windows blown out after a car bombing, and everybody else in the neighborhood has their windows blown out too, is it hard to get the windows replaced?
No. Well, we actually had Mylar, what's called Mylar, on our windows, and so a lot. They were. I think we counted. I think it was 109 panes of glass were blown out in one way or another, or shattered in the bombing. But a lot of the windows, like in my bedroom, for example, which was a good thing because it was facing the hotel, we had this stuff called Mylar, which kind of the window breaks, but it doesn't shatter in quite the same way, and it doesn't blow out. And so it kind of lessens, you know, it lessens the amount of glass that's flying through the air when windows come undone. But no, you can actually, all of our windows have been replaced, and hopefully that won't happen again.
Last month, the Los Angeles Times reported that the Pentagon was covertly placing pro-American stories in Iraqi news outlets. And I'm wondering if you had any clue about that, if you read any of these stories that were actually planted by the Pentagon, and if you knew that, or if you were surprised to find that out.
No, I mean I didn't, but in terms of reading them, no. I mean, these are things that go in, you know, Arabic newspapers, and I think, you know, for the most part, they were pretty benign. I mean, it was, you know, Captain Jones is putting the finishing touches on, you know, the school he's just painted in, you know, Eastern Baghdad, and you know that I think it was kind of more of that nature, and I don't know, maybe I have a slightly different view about all this, but you know, the reality in Iraq is so overwhelming for anyone who's there. And it sure is in Baghdad. It's so utterly overwhelming that I kind of feel like you could set up, or they, you know, the American government could have set up a 100-mile-long, you know, movie screen and broadcast any kind of propaganda they wanted to, and it wouldn't have changed anybody's mind about anything. I mean, they're too immersed in the reality of the situation, you know, for that kind of thing to make any kind of difference.
Does a story like that, you know, the fact that the Pentagon was placing articles, pro-American articles, in newspapers and other news outlets in Iraq, does that have an impact on you as an American journalist in Iraq? Do other Iraqis look at you and think, well, maybe he's a plant too, maybe he's getting paid by the government to say positive things?
No, not really. I mean, they kind of already think that anyway. I mean,
the typical
Iraqi doesn't make much of a distinction between, you know, an American who looks like me and an American who is wearing a military uniform, or, you know, is a diplomat or a spy for that matter. They kind of, it's just one big thing. And it's one of the reasons, frankly, why we reporters are in danger. Because those kinds of very basic distinctions that anybody would appreciate here aren't made in that, and you know, aren't made in that country. So in that sense, no, it hasn't really affected what we do. But it's for, you know, for reasons which are less obvious.
You've been back in the States for basically a couple of days, and you're heading back tonight. Is that an odd position to be in? Because, you know, if you're back in the States for a while, you can kind of get into a different mindset. But if you're back for a couple of days, maybe you can't afford to really do that, because you have to jump right back into the Iraq mindset right away. So have you been in a kind of like mental limbo in a way?
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to pretend like I'm not here, you know. I'm trying to stay in Iraq. And I'm trying to, you know, because it's usually, in addition to everything else it is, when you go back to Iraq, it's kind of depressing because it's very, very hard. And it's very cut off from the rest of the world, and you know, it's violent, and you have to be very, very careful. And so it's just kind of, you know, it's not like a day at the beach, and so you know, I've been kind of cranked up in that mode for several weeks now, and I don't want to step out of that just yet. So if you saw me walking down the street today, maybe you would have noticed. But I'm just trying to stay in Iraq, like mentally, until I get back, and then, you know, a few more weeks, and then I'll be out.
Dexter Filkins, thank you very much, and I wish you a safe trip back to Baghdad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a Baghdad correspondent for the New York Times. I spoke with him late yesterday afternoon at the end of a 2-day trip to the U.S.